From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a bomb in the brain. While recovering from brain surgery, journalist Steve Fishman interviewed surgeons and observed brain operations. He came to feel like a spy, a patient who had slipped behind the lines and was given special access to the precision and mayhem of high-tech medicine. Also today, we meet jazz trombonist Ray Anderson. The man Downbeat magazine voted the top jazz trombonist 2 years straight, has a new album. And we have some old favorites that deserve a new look. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's Showboat. And Ken Tucker reviews Christmas movies now out on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Five years ago, journalist Steve Fishman was traveling through Nicaragua on a grant when a blood vessel popped in his brain. His vision swirled, and he had the worst headache of his life. But it wasn't until 2 weeks later, when he flew home to New York, that his brain hemorrhage was diagnosed. He underwent brain surgery. 3 holes were drilled in his head, the blood clot was sucked out, and the cause of the hemorrhage was excised. 1 year later, just as he thought he'd recovered, he had a seizure and was diagnosed with epilepsy, probably related to the surgery. Throughout his ordeal, Fishman took notes on his own experiences. He interviewed his doctors and other neurosurgeons at the hospital. He sat in on other patients' brain operations and was even given a videotape of his own surgery. The rebellious brain from the perspective of patient and doctor is the subject of his new book, A Bomb in the Brain. Fishman writes that when he first went into surgery, his editor at Science Digest suggested it was a great opportunity for a story. The editor offered to send a photographer to take pictures of Fishman being wheeled into the operating room. At the time, Fishman thought this sounded exploitive, but he ended up becoming obsessed with investigating and writing about his condition. I asked him why he changed his mind.
I think that I did it out of habit first. I found myself taking notes during the operation. During the hospitalization, I found that I was talking to people and wanting to find out things about what was going on. And then it was later that I decided, well, since I've done the bulk of the research, I might as well go ahead and write this article. It was as I wrote the article that this thing became, and it's only looking back that I kind of realized this, it really did become this obsession. I just always wanted to know more about it. I wanted to hang out with these people. I wanted to, you know, not only meet my doctors, but go to dinner at their houses. And I think that in some ways it probably became a little out of control. Looking back, I'm not sure it was probably the healthiest thing to do.
Why not?
It wasn't the healthiest thing to do because it would have been great to put it behind me. I think that in the long term, maybe the way to put it behind me, for me, was to exhaustively research the topic. If there had been another way to do it, I would have been very happy to take that way. If I could have been the type of person who could have said, well, 2 weeks in the hospital, I've had brain surgery, hey, it's a bad haircut, nothing more, you know, let's move on, that would have been fine. I found out that I wasn't that type of person, and it really did take up a couple years of my life.
You know, I was wondering if being able to interview your doctors and to be the journalist and not just the patient gave you more equality in the relationship. Because I know so often when you're sick, or especially if it's a life-threatening problem, the doctor seems to have so much power and you feel so weak and sometimes kind of inconsequential as well.
Yeah, that is true. When you're in the hospital, you feel a little bit like you're being ministered by a bureaucrat. He's got a certain amount of time for you, and he is busy. But you really do feel like you're this person, and kind of one moment to the next, you might be in urgent need, and you're not sure that the person that you need to call on is going to be busy or not. Interviewing my doctors really did put me on a different level between them, between me and them. What happened, though, wasn't exactly equality. It was as if I was being a spy, because I never really left behind this status of being a patient. I was always someone who was being treated, someone who had been ill. And even when I was given this permission to kind of sneak behind the lines, in fact, be escorted behind the lines of this really high-powered medicine and into the operating room and with the residents, I always felt like I had the status of someone who had been a patient. And so while I had this increased knowledge, it wasn't exactly equality. It was some kind of, I don't know exactly how to describe it. It almost felt a little bit like I shouldn't be doing it, like I was doing something under false pretenses.
Well, you said you felt like a spy, and I'm wondering if you learned things about brain surgeons that you feel that brain surgeons would prefer to keep from patients and lay people.
The short answer, I think, is yes. The long answer is that brain surgeons are actually, I found, incredibly open people. And once you make that crossover from being a patient who is someone who really doesn't get any information to being a colleague or some kind of peer, you're let in on almost everything. And there I was in the operating room as equipment broke and tempers raged, and I was sure that the person asleep on the table was going to do nothing but die. And that's for a patient, and maybe for anyone who doesn't have that kind of experience, nothing short of a horrifying experience. Being in an operating room with the surgeon who was my surgeon, it was the first time that I'd attended a brain surgery when I was awake for it. And suddenly the aneurysm, which is this pressurized bubble that comes off of an artery, bursts. There's blood filling the small portion of the head that they're working on. And suddenly the equipment breaks. They couldn't proceed to work on it. And this is the time in an operation when it's absolutely critical to get to work. That much I knew. There was a combination of hysteria and silence in the operating room. And I reacted to this like a tourist, like someone going to a play, like someone moseying around the scene of an accident. All I really had for cues were the dramatic ones. You know, people shouting, people saying unfriendly things to people with whom they were friends. I had, you know, nothing short of the experience of a catastrophe. Now, whether that experience is good for every patient who's going to undergo a brain surgery, I think it probably isn't.
I would doubt it, actually. Let's talk a little bit about your story, about what happened to you. You were in Nicaragua on a grant. Mm-hmm. And it was a really worst-case scenario. Here you are in a third-world country with a life-threatening illness, a blood vessel burst in your brain. It's not only a third-world country, it's a revolutionary country which your government is trying to overthrow. Plus, you're broke. So that's the scenario. What were your first symptoms?
I was standing in a hotel lobby, actually trying to get a room, which they told me wasn't available, when suddenly, and I mean that in the most literal sense, like a thunderbolt, I got this unbelievable pain in the back of my head, which was accompanied by a total blurring of my vision from one second to the next.
You went to a hospital, you saw several doctors, and they all misdiagnosed you. What were some of the things you were told by the doctors you saw?
Well, what happened was I began this, was an adventure, a medical adventure. I actually had always wanted to learn more about the Sandinista healthcare system, which is very good for certain kinds of illnesses. And here I was telling myself at one point, a chance to take a kind of an introductory course. What I did was I went to the hospital, and I was in this waiting room with women with their babies who were screaming, sitting on this hard bench, staring at my hands, which were kind of shimmering, hoping that some doctor who I'd never met, who my country was funding a war against, would take me by the shoulders and say something like, "Son, it's going to be all right." The doctor, in fact, looked at me and said, "I can't find anything wrong," which was about the most benign diagnosis I got. I continued to go to doctors, some of them in the public sector, some of them in the private sector. One doctor in the private sector looked down my throat and said, "Well, why didn't you tell me this? Your throat is red. All you've got is a virus." Now, that sounds ridiculous now, knowing that I had a brain hemorrhage. But at the moment, it was great news. I thought, this man is wonderful. Why didn't anyone else tell me this? I'm just going to go home and lie down for a while. The problem, of course, was that lying down didn't do anything for my headache, which continued to beat like some kind of hammer on my head. And my vision, which was kind of getting a little bit better at the sides, but which still left me feeling like a blind person crossing the street by listening to cars. It took me about 2 weeks, really, seven doctors. About the only good part of it was that my total cost of medical care was $95. It took me those 2 weeks to figure out that it was time to return to the United States, get another medical opinion.
Which is what you did. Let me reintroduce you. My guest is Steve Fishman, and he's written a book called A Bomb in the Brain, which tells his own story of having brain surgery for a cerebral hemorrhage. And he also interviewed his doctors and other doctors in the hospital where he stayed. How much did you want to know before you had the operation? And I ask this because I think I'm the kind of person who wants to know some things but wants other things withheld. I don't want to be able to visualize too much about what's going on inside there.
I wanted to know nothing most of the time.
Now, why did that change after the surgery? After the surgery, you went in and sat in on other similar operations. Why did you want to actually see what brain operations look like?
I think it was perverse, really. I can't tell you. I've talked to so many people about it now, and including psychiatrists and psychologists, and one of the theories that was put forth was that this was my way of getting over it. Uh-huh. You know, I really did think that brain surgery was something that I was going to check into the hospital, check out of the hospital, and I was going to get back into the race, whatever race that was. I thought that I spent my bottom dollar, my total savings, buying a computer because I thought that there were things that I had to write, stories that I had to get on with. And I got out of the hospital and found that that there was something going on. I can't tell you exactly what, but I think that there was an adjustment period. I slept longer. I had all these weird and stupid little ailments that I was embarrassed to tell people about. I was emotional about the fates of other people. I snapped at friends. Things that, looking back, I think really have to do with what is a critical emotional experience. For me, going back and trying to understand that experience was the way that I dealt with those emotions.
After your surgery, you sat in on other surgery and watched it standing right next to the surgeons. Is there an image that stays with you most from the surgery that you saw?
Well, I don't think I'll forget the image of the first operation that I attended. I've mentioned that before, but the image that comes on my mind, what you should understand is that you actually do, as an observer, stand in an operating room. You can actually lean over the shoulder of a surgeon and peer into this 2-inch square that's been carved out of a person's skull. Look at the curves of his brain. The better view, however, is on the video screen, which in the case of the operating room I was in was maybe 4 or 5 feet from where the surgeon was working. And he works through a microscope. That microscope projects onto this video screen what is being seen. So I could see in living color, 19-inch diameter, what he was seeing in the head in quarter-inch, half-inch diameter. And there was a moment during that operation when the when the bloody malformation, much like the one that I had in my head, ruptured, that means that the surgeon suddenly lost control of it. It was bleeding uncontrollably for at least a few seconds, and maybe for more. Someone was bleeding to death on the operating table. And what I saw was this 19-inch diameter screen suddenly fill with red. It's an image that actually still kind of makes me stop and want to do some deep breathing exercises. The operating room is an incredibly dramatic situation. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, oftentimes, it is routine. Surgeons are very skillful. The equipment is solid. And they're also lucky. You know, everything goes well. But there are some times when things go wrong, when tempers flare, when equipment breaks down. There was one time in an operating room when a laser that's used to cut out certain kinds of tumor actually ignited the sheets that covered the body of the sleeping patient, and there was a fire in an operating room. I mean, things happen. There's just too many human factors and too many machine factors for things not to happen in an operating room. So it is this, it's a real drama. And I think every time I went in there, I had a little bit the feeling that I had when I start a roller coaster ride.
I want to talk with you more about what you experienced and what you learned both about your own brain hemorrhage and about neurosurgery in general. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest, Steve Fishman, has written a memoir called A Bomb in the Brain. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Steve Fishman was on a reporter's grant in Nicaragua when he had a cerebral hemorrhage. He made it back to the United States, and while he was in the hospital as a brain surgery patient, Fishman was also standing back observing the experience. He returned to the hospital after his recovery to see what had gone on behind the scenes. His new book, A Bomb in the Brain, is the result of his attempt to understand his illness and its treatment. You were able to actually experience what might be like the ultimate in metaphysics or something, which is like the brain watching itself. You actually watched a videotape of your own brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things you saw in watching the videotape was the little hole in your brain where what the little piece of tissue had to be cut out.
Mm-hmm.
Now you will always have that image of your brain with a little hole in it. Is that good to have that kind of visual representation of something that you would otherwise never see because one doesn't see their brain?
I don't know if it's good. I really don't. If I had it to do over again, maybe I wouldn't do it. I really did get on this this line of research that I couldn't stop. And and for me, what happened was that in the end, it gave me an appreciation of brain surgery, an appreciation of medicine that I don't think a lot of people have. For one thing, I did get to see the videotape of my operation. All major teaching hospitals videotape operations. I don't think any of them show them to the patients. Because of the relationship that I had with my brain surgeon, he said, sure, I'll show it to you. I think it also had to do with the fact that I was a reporter who seemingly didn't have any ill effects, any side effects from my surgery. So he said, let's sit down, I'll show it to you. I thought that when I saw that videotape, I was going to be smart and reasoned. I was going to ask kind of bright questions. I was going to say, well, doctor, what's the name of this blood vessel? And, you know, that's a little bit larger than I thought. My brain came onto the screen. It looked to me like cottage cheese. I just had this image of cottage cheese. I think my jaw hit the table, and I said, in my smart, reasoned way, I said, oh, boy. And that was about all I could muster for minutes. The thing looked to me like some scene of a natural disaster. I thought that, you know, and I'd seen brain surgery, so I don't know what I was really expecting. But here I was watching a horror film all of a sudden. I was not this kind of reportorial person with a list of questions and a microphone. I was somebody reacting to an event that had gone on and had really affected them in a very personal way. You know, there is something about this that I think that people who have any kind of surgery, any kind of illness, indulge themselves. And other people think they're complaining. And certainly I indulged myself. I luxuriated in this kind of retrospective terror, all the things I imagined that could happen to me, that could have happened to me, and some that did happen to me. But there is an aspect of kind of emotional reconditioning I'm really convinced of, and it's not just my own experience, it's talking to other people. After you get sick, getting better is a process of getting used to what happened to you. I think in my case, it took me too long. I'm not always sure that process is completed. But there is a very long and difficult process that you go through of readjusting to yourself as someone who's been medically fixed. And what complicates that process is that people don't believe you. They think that you're complaining or that you're making too much of it, that you're exaggerating, and so does the medical community. They tell you, take it easy. They tell you, you get better. My surgeon was very understanding. My neurologists were very understanding. But they're very separate from the experience that I had as a patient. And what I think worked for me in this book, and maybe in the experience as a whole, is that I got to live the experience from both sides. I got to be both a patient having this excruciating personal experience and then move to the doctor's side and watch what kind of finesse and care and real concern goes into it. It left me with an appreciation with both sides and also an appreciation of the gulf that there is between the patient and the doctor.
After you thought you were pretty well recovered from your brain surgery, you had a seizure, and you were diagnosed by your doctor as having epilepsy resulting from some scar tissue in the brain left from the operation. You are still in the process of interviewing your doctor, and the subject of the epilepsy that resulted from the operation came up. And I'm interested in hearing whether you wanted to know if he felt remorseful that you had this terrible lifelong after effect as a result of the operation, or if brain surgery is such a difficult and precise type of surgery that it's just kind of expected that this kind of thing might happen, if it goes with the territory. Did you talk about that with him?
I did talk about that with him. It was almost the last conversation we had. And I think it was something that I wanted to put off. I think that my emotions as a patient were very complicated. And I think that all patients must have complicated emotions, especially towards their doctors. You know, here's the guy who saves your life, does nothing short of that. Mm-hmm. And yet there's part of you that, and I don't think this is really too strong a word, that hates this guy, that experiences an emotion of anger. It's certainly nothing that I would express. My surgeon's an extremely scholarly, scientific, and able surgeon. And yet there's a part of me that knows that I'm the guy who was asleep on the table and woke up sometime later with epilepsy, and he walked away. And there's something in that inequality that bugged me. In looking back at this interview, and in re-listening to it, since it's on a tape recording that I made, what I find is that what I'm really angry about is, and what I really want to kind of bring up to the surgeon in a way is, I have seizures and you don't. You know, medicine was the miracle that was supposed to deliver me. Surgery in particular was the technique that was supposed to kind of was supposed to usher me into and out of the hospital and then let me go back to my normal life. And here I am spending all my waking hours wondering about whether I'm going to have a seizure. So the answer is yes, I really was angry at him, and I think I really did want him to feel a kind of remorse. I guess I have to add that I know that the guy is a very human individual who feels very much about what he does, and who probably, you know, surgeons can't cross that line. They can't start feeling remorse for every patient that they have. They'd never be able to operate.
Well, let me just ask you briefly, was this something terrible that went wrong in the surgery? Was this a terrible error on the surgeon's part, or is this a fairly typical side effect of an operation that otherwise saved your life?
Yeah, I don't want to leave that impression at all. No, the surgery was a success. I had another surgeon look at the videotape of my operation. I kind of showed it around rather than get out a tape from the video store. I showed the video of my operation around, and another surgeon said it was an absolute tour de force. So the technique was flawless. The epilepsy could be a result of the initial brain hemorrhage that I experienced in Nicaragua, which did a considerable amount of violence to the cerebral terrain. I mean, you can see it. It looks like the fist of some newborn was punched a hole in the back of my brain. Or it can be, in a certain number of cases, a side effect of brain surgery that's unavoidable. You know, the statistics vary depending on the site and on the type of operation.
What's next for you now? You've, I guess, completed the assignment on reporting on your own condition. What's next?
Well, I was thinking of getting a paying job. bagging groceries at the Grand Union had occurred to me. I'm in the strange position of having a credential for writing about health and medicine now.
Uh-huh.
And finding myself not being terribly interested about it, about medicine and health. I think for me this was in ways a self-contained experience, and it was in part writing about me and exploring my reactions to things that so fascinated me. And I realized that all the egocentric apologies I'm going to have to make later. But I think it is true that what this was, it was an experience of a crisis, and that crisis could have been anything. But it was going through it that was so challenging for me. And I don't really know what to do next. I'm open to ideas.
Well, I wish you the best with whatever you decide to do, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you, Terry.
Steve Fishman's book about his experience as a brain surgery patient is called A Bomb in the Brain, and it's just been published by Scribner's. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ray Anderson has won the Downbeat Critics Poll for Best Trombonist for the past 2 years. He has a new album, and coming up, the trombonist tells us about playing sounds, not just notes. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Kern and Hammerstein's classic musical, Showboat. This version includes songs that were cut before the show premiered on Broadway in 1927, as well as music added for the movie versions and later Broadway revivals. And if you're tired of watching It's a Wonderful Life every Christmas, critic Ken Tucker suggests some alternative holiday fare, now available on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A Pan Am 747 on a flight from London's Heathrow Airport to Kennedy Airport in New York crashed in a small Scottish town less than an hour after taking off today. NPR's Bill Buesenberg reports from London.
This will be Great Britain's worst air disaster. Among the more than 250 people on board were American soldiers from West Germany and students from Syracuse University in New York. There were at least 12 casualties on the ground. Pan Am Flight 103 left Heathrow in London shortly after 6 p.m. local time and was at 31,000 feet on course for New York when it suddenly disappeared from Scotland radar less than an hour later. The pilot had no time to report that his plane was in trouble. Many eyewitnesses said the plane was on fire as it slammed into the small town of Lockerbie. Cars on a highway, a gas station, and as many as 20 to 30 houses were caught in the resulting explosion and flames. Debris covered an 8-mile area. Reporter David Nisbet said the nose cone of the plane was embedded in the ground several miles from the town.
One of the medics told me, who was up here at the site about 3 miles from Lockerbie, that they found the nose of the aircraft. And in this debris, they found the crew members, the pilot, the co-pilot and navigator, and other members of the cabin staff. Also, other bodies of passengers were found there. The doctor told me in all, he had found 16.
That's 16 of the passengers on board. I'm Bill Buesenberg in London.
An Army intelligence officer involved in intercepting East Bloc military communications has been arrested on suspicion of espionage. Warrant Officer First Class James William Hall was arrested by Army intelligence agents after a search of his Georgia home today. NPR's David Mulpas has details.
Army officials in Washington say the alleged espionage occurred while Warrant Officer Hall was stationed in the United States and in Europe. He served in an intelligence section in West Germany, had top-secret clearance and regular access to classified information. Officials say his duties included intercepting and decoding secret Eastern Bloc communications. Officials say Hall is suspected of spying for East Germany. While officials said little publicly about the possible damage done to U.S. security, the arrest raises the possibility that the Soviets and their allies may have learned a great deal about U.S. intelligence collection capabilities. UPI quotes government authorities saying it's a major case. Just 4 months ago, a retired U.S. Army sergeant was arrested in West Germany and charged with selling secrets to Hungarian intelligence. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Polish leader Wojciech Jaruzelski today shook up the ruling Politburo. He removed 6 hardliners and veterans in favor of younger pragmatists. One of those promoted to full membership in the Politburo was a liberal who has been active in conducting talks with Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa. Jaruzelski said the changes were necessary for the success of party reforms. After 7 weeks of political maneuvering, Israel's Labor Party agreed to form a coalition government led by the Likud Party. The agreement forms an alliance between Foreign Minister Shimon Peres and Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, similar to one that has governed the country for the last 4 years. The coalition has made it difficult for Israel to pursue a consistent policy on the violence in the occupied territories. The left-center Labor Party favors giving up some land in return for peace, while the rightist Likud Party rejects any territorial concessions. PLO leader Yasser Arafat today accused Israel of trying to spoil, damage, and sabotage the talks between the PLO and the U.S. Arafat is traveling through Europe and the Middle East, hoping to gain support for an international conference on the Middle East. Stock prices were down slightly today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost a little more than a point to close at 21.64 on volume of 147 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Recently, there's been an interest in re-recording classic Broadway musicals with their original songs and orchestrations. Such versions of Follies, Of Thee I Sing, and Sound of Music have already been released. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says one of the best and most complete of these revivals is a recording of Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein's Showboat with Frederica von Stade, Jerry Hadley, Teresa Stratus, and even Lillian Gish.
Everybody knows Showboat. Songs like Old Man River, Bill, Make Believe, Can't Help Lovin' That Man, Why Do I Love You, flow in the collective American bloodstream. But this new album is unprecedented in its completeness. It not only has the entire original score, but even all the numbers that were either cut out or added in later productions. And they're all placed in the context of a powerful and brilliantly constructed music drama. Showboat was produced in 1927, and it's probably the first serious musical in Broadway history. It's not just romantic entertainment. It also deals with our heritage of racial prejudice and with the changes in American culture between the late 1880s and 1927. Its self-conscious sense of theatricality, its show-within-a-show plot, provides the perfect backdrop for the deceptions and self-deceptions of the main characters, all of them actors on the Showboat. Julie Laverne, the star who conceals her mixed blood in order to pass for white. Magnolia Hawks and Gaylord Ravenel, the lovers who would rather make believe than face their real difficulties. Even Ellie, the comedienne, admits that life upon the wicked stage ain't nothing like what her fans expect.
Life upon the wicked stage ain't ever what a girl saw. Stage door Johnnies aren't raging over you with gems and roses. When you let a feller hold your hand, which means an extra beer or sandwich, everybody whispers, ain't her life a whirl?
Showboat celebrates theater, but also evaluates it, especially by measuring it against natural feeling and the force of nature itself.
It's wearing and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But Old Man River, he just keeps rolling on.
One thing that struck me about the complete score of Showboat was its complex and sophisticated structure. Take the extraordinary overture, for example, recorded here in its original version for the first time. The opening theme anticipates one of the most touching moments in the show. Not a song, but a little verse that Julie sings, her premonition of disaster.
Oh!
It's the same theme we hear when young Magnolia is offstage practicing the piano. The tune runs like an operatic motif through the whole show. The next theme in the overture is Can't Help Lovin' That Man, which is not only one of Jerome Kern's best-loved ballads, it's also central to the plot, a song that only black people are supposed to know. Why should a star like Julie Laverne know it? This theme is followed by music from the powerful choral lament sung by the black workers as they polish the Showboat Auditorium. Misery's Coming Around, a number that was actually cut out of Showboat after its first tryout performance. This is its first recording. The original orchestrations, complete with banjo, are terrific. John McGlynn conducts the London Sinfonietta with verve and the right period flavor. The cast is uniformly excellent. But as Julie, the role created by Helen Morgan, soprano Teresa Strada stands out. Her wrenching performance can already be included among the legendary ones.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Angel recording of Showboat. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Gary Giddens of the Village Voice called Ray Anderson one of the most compellingly original trombonists of the past decade. Anderson was voted best trombonist in the 1988 Downbeat Critics Poll. He tied for first in 1987. He's played and recorded with musicians such as Carla Bley, Anthony Davis, Gil Evans, Charlie Hayden, and Anthony Braxton. He leads a quintet on his new album, Blues, Bread, and the Bone. Here's the title track. Did you always play with growls and smears?
Yes, I suppose I always did. I started off listening to Dixieland music, so it was always apparent to me that that was something you could do with a trombone. I don't know exactly, you know, what I sounded like many years ago, but I suppose I always had that in the lexicon somewhere.
But when you were first playing trombone in the 50s and 60s, the kind of jazz that was current at the time was bop, and I don't think that bop trombonists really used those colors in their playing.
That's true. And for that reason, I always felt a great frustration with the bop language scene. It always appeared to me that even the very best of the bop trombonists, like J.J. and Curtis Fuller and these other really magnificent players, were still somehow a step behind the trumpet and saxophone, just in the fluency and the ease with which they could dash off those kind of bop language phrase things. So I was always looking for something else to do, and in that sense, the Ellington tradition or the Dixieland tradition as carried on by, say, Roswell Rudd was very important to me as soon as I was getting any awareness at all of, like, you know, what to do with music or try and develop a style and, you know, was moving beyond just playing in between baseball games or something, you know.
Do you use mutes a lot? And if so, what kinds do you like to use?
Actually, the only mute I like is plunger.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also have a little trumpet mute that I put inside the trombone on occasion and then use the plunger over that. That's the Tricky Sam legacy. That's like you get that sort of Tricky Sam sound from that.
And Tricky Sam Natten was one of the trombonists in the Ellington band.
Yes, right. The real, you know, Tricky Sam and Barbara Miley are really the inventors of plunger. Period from the Ellington band, and some of the stuff they did is still like the most unbelievable sound. So it remains a powerful inspiration for those of us that fool with the plunger.
When you're using a plunger mute, do you make it out of a plunger, or do you go to a music shop and buy a plunger mute?
No, it's a plunger. And a problem is that I find the old plungers, which were made out of very hard rubber, have a better sound than the ones you can buy nowadays, which are very soft and pliant. So this has become a kind of problem. It's like how to find an old plunger. You know, I have a fairly old one and would like to find yet an older one. Maybe if somebody has one, they could mail it in to the station or something.
One of the things I really like about your playing is your playing really has a sense of humor to it. And I think that's especially evident on your interpretation of Mona Lisa. I think the arrangement's great. It has all these clashing international styles, reggae, cha-cha.
Yeah, it's the Andersonorious dance groove, whatever that is.
You grew up in Chicago.
Yes.
And when you started playing trombone in school, you played with George Lewis, who's now a new music and jazz trombonist, too.
Mm-hmm.
Did you realize when you were playing together, when you were kids, that you would both end up remaining serious about the instrument?
No, not at all. I don't think either one of us had any inkling that we would still be at it all these years later.
What made you realize that you were serious?
Actually, I stopped playing when I got out of high school and I was 16, and all I knew really was that I hated school. I always hated school. And so my parents were kind enough to say, well, okay, so don't go on to college right away. You know, so they set up this thing where I went to Europe at that age and sort of bummed around for a year. I had a bunch of contacts of friends of theirs and, you know, just traveled around. And I went extremely lightly. I didn't take a trombone. I took a soprano saxophone, which would jam in my backpack, and a couple recorders, and went off on this year and gradually realized that I could not exist without playing. And it became about you know, jam sessions in these youth hostels and with whatever guitar player you could find and whatever. And my little arsenal of instruments kept growing. Pretty soon I had soprano, three recorders, one half of a tabla drum set. You know, it was like, so I you know, I sort of discovered at that point that how important that really was to me. I had been doing it in high school, but didn't realize that it was so central to my whole being. As, you know, it's like when I stopped, then I realized I couldn't stop.
On your new record, you have a lot of, you know, you have four interesting musicians with you. It's not a working band, though. This is not a band that you keep on salary and tour with and perform with. You brought these guys together for the record. Is that right?
Right.
Is it hard to keep together a working band? Has it been hard for you to, is that something you'd like to do but haven't been able to do?
Exactly. That is something that I really look forward to being able to do and at the moment cannot do. You know, I have work and then I have long periods without work, you know. I just went to Europe for about 3.5 weeks, and it's great what happens to a band, you know, when you have, like, work every night for that kind of period of time. But now, you know, I don't actually know when my next period of concentrated work will be. So I have to hire who's available at what time, and there hasn't been a great deal of consistency of personnel. In a way, that's also fine because I'm sort of still beginning as a band leader, and it's nice to be able to try out different people. But I look forward to the day when there's enough work to be able to say, okay, you know, here's, this is the band here, you know, make a commitment to this because there's enough work that you could make a commitment to it, you know.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you. It's really fun.
Ray Anderson's new album, Blues, Bread, and the Bone, is on the Gaia label. This is Fresh Air. Alex Chadwick is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Alex. What story is he following?
Hi, Terry. You may know that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has decided today that the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant can begin low-power testing. This is the power plant in New Hampshire that's been the subject of so much controversy. People protesting its opening for many years. People including Governor Dukakis of Massachusetts. The protesters are continuing their efforts to keep Seabrook from beginning operation, but it may begin operation in 2 weeks or so. Also a report on President-elect Bush's policy for aid for the Contras and the history of Christmas carols.
Thanks, Alex. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There are several new Christmas movies playing in theaters this season, like Scrooged and Ernest Saves Christmas. But critic Ken Tucker says it's the old ones that are sometimes most comforting, and a lot of those are now available on home video. Ken's got a review of one of his favorites.
With the advent of the video revolution, a new Christmas tradition has taken hold. Rent a bunch of holiday movies, pop some microwave popcorn, and sit back to await the arrival of Santa Claus. These days, you don't have to be content with watching Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life for the 100th time either. More and more classic holiday films are coming out on cassette. This year's big title, for example, is probably the 1951 British version of A Christmas Carol, starring Alastair Sim as Scrooge. But I'd like to call your attention to a sleeper, a less well-known film that's a very satisfying Christmas movie. The Bishop's Wife, made in 1947, has a great cast, Cary Grant, David Niven, and Loretta Young. It's about the travails of an ambitious young Episcopal bishop, played by Niven, who's having trouble raising the funds for the cathedral he wants to build in his sleepy New England town. Loretta Young is his long-suffering wife, and Cary Grant plays a dapper angel in a business suit sent down from heaven to show this couple the meaning of true happiness. All this takes place during the week before Christmas. It sounds gloppy, and as directed by Henry Coster, it sometimes is. But more often than that, The Bishop's Wife is gently funny and truly original, a rare example of a religious comedy that's both true to its faith and dryly witty. Early in the film, Cary Grant first appears to a very startled David Niven.
Look, I'm afraid I must ask you to telephone my secretary for an appointment. I'm in the middle of dinner.
I know, Henry. Your soup will keep warm. You asked for help.
Who told you I asked for help?
Well, you were known to be a good man, Henry, and you were heard. I was instructed to come here in answer to your prayer.
Who are you?
I'm an angel.
I beg your pardon?
I'm an angel. No wings at the moment, but...
You're an angel. I knew it. I've been working too hard.
In The Bishop's Wife, the Christmas spirit involves rediscovering the small pleasures in life, trimming a Christmas tree, singing carols, recognizing your own good fortune. This isn't a new message, but it's one that the movie delivers with a minimum of sentimentality. Although much of it is couched as comedy, we do get to see the way priests must cater to their parishioners in a delicate system of emotional politics. What comes across is the idea that a church is a business as well as a source of comfort and inspiration. As the bishop's wife, Loretta Young is dreamily depressed. She feels that David Niven is pursuing his career goals without taking her happiness into account. The movie strongly implies that Young is thoroughly infatuated with the suave, handsome angel, and that's understandable. I mean, imagine meeting someone who looks like Cary Grant who can also walk through walls. As for Grant himself, he's interestingly reined in here. He holds back, as if content to let David Niven's fuss-budget bishop get all the good laughs. The result is one of Grant's most charming performances, simply because he looks so genial and at ease with himself. There are a lot of Christmas cassettes around, everything from White Christmas to Miracle on 34th Street to my favorite holiday cartoon, Mr. Magoo's Christmas. But The Bishop's Wife is the one to munch popcorn by if you're up for something a little more low-key and different.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from two performers with a country influence, Jesse Winchester and Guy Clark. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews two current comedies, The Naked Gun, from the same folks who made Airplane, and Dirty Rotten Scoundrel, starring Steve Martin and Michael Caine. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Cherry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.